Well, it's already Chodesh Nisan. Pesach is coming, and we've got to get ready for Haggadah. One of the most difficult things about teaching Haggadah is its familiarity. In general, teaching texts that people are familiar with is a challenge because either they want to find something new that they haven't thought of, which is, of course, always a good challenge. But also, there is a general feeling that the text is so well known that you sort of have to break down what people know about it. For instance, the hardest Perek Tehillim I found to teach is Perek Kuf Mem Hei, because everybody knows Ashrei. They know Ashrei so well, they don't realize how much they don't know it. And so we'll have to do a little breakdown here. But Dayenu is a very popular part of everybody's Seder. Matter of fact, here in L.A., we're familiar with the Tehrani custom. I think it's a universal Persian custom, and which is to hold scallions during Dayenu and whip the person next to you with the scallions. And Dayenu, of course, is a very popular song and all well-known, and yet Dayenu is not really well understood. Important to note before going further that Dayenu is not part of the original core Haggadah. As to what constitutes the original Kor Haggadah, that's something certainly that can be debated as to how much of the Midrashim are part of it. But Dayenu does not appear anywhere until the 10th century, when it shows up in Rav Sadia Gaon's Sidur as a nice hymn for some people to sing after the Seder. And then after a couple hundred years, it starts making its way into Haggadot, and now it is quite universal, nearly universal. And yet, Dayenu, because of its popularity, as I say, kind of eludes analysis. So instead of trying to do this at the Seder, when it would be very unpopular, we're going to do it right now, and hopefully it'll bring a fresh understanding and appreciation for it. The first thing is, if you take a look at Dayenu, it's right here on page one, the whole thing. And thank you, Jason. There's five questions. I didn't want to do four questions because that would be too cliche. So there's five. Why you look at Dayenu, and the first question to ask is, how many different items are we mentioning here in history? I'll make this a little bit smaller so that we can see it a little bit better. There we go. How many different items are there here that we're mentioning? Why is it 15? Because what's the formula?
The 15 steps in the Beit HaMikdash.
No, that's not why there's 15. But how do you know there's 15? Look at it. There's 14 lines. How do you know there's 15?
I thought it came from that.
No, well, look, I'm saying, look at the text, and I'm asking, how many items are we mentioning here? And you said 15. I said, how do you get 15? I didn't ask where do you think it came from?
No, I'm saying I didn't even look. I just knew that.
Well, but look at it.
How I see. You?
14.
Formula. What's the formula?
On each line.
What?
There are two statements on each line. So the 14th one ends with 15.
It'll be 28 then.
Well, it repeats the next line has the first of the last one.
Well, what's the formula one. Is if A but not B, if B but not C, etc. Since you're always going to have one more than the amount of lines that are there. So there's 15 different items that are mentioned that we are mentioning in this passage. All right, good. So we get it. However, if you take a look at the entire section, and it's all part of one hymn, you'll notice that the same 15 items are listed twice. They're listed here, and they're listed here. So why do we have the same list twice? Kind of strange. The other thing is, if you look at the list, you will notice that the list seems to be somewhat, not arbitrarily, but falsely extended. Now, for instance, look at the lines that I highlighted. Look at line Vav. Right, line 6. If God had split the sea but not walked us through. Well, it's kind of unclear to me what the value of splitting the sea is if we don't go through. And by the way, the same thing with the next line. But the whole point of having the sea split was to give us an avenue to leave Mitzrayim, and then drowning the Egyptians also is an added piece. But that line is unnecessary. Meaning, had we read Hey to Zion, watch this. Ilu natan lanu et mamonam v'lo karalanu teyam. Dayenu. Ilu aviranu b'tochah v'charavah v'lo shamam b'tochah shikatsorim b'tochah. Dayenu. Line 5 is unneeded. Line Tet is another one that's unneeded. Because had God not fed us for 40 years, but not fed us the man, well, that's what he fed us. It's the same thing. And the real doozy, which, of course, every Haggadah has commentaries on this, is line 12. Ilu kevanu lifnei har Sinai velo natan lanu et haTorah dayenu. The whole purpose of coming to har Sinai was matan Torah. So, of course, we can darshan, we could say, well, there actually was an experiential piece of being at har Sinai alone without matan. Very nice, but let's be honest. Coming to har Sinai, the purpose of it was to matan Torah. So the line your best seems to be an extra. So it seems that the author is trying to elongate this list beyond its necessary components, or even components that add to its meaning. So it's a little bit strange. The next question I want to ask is, if you look at the top line and you can see the introductory line to this piece, uses two words that are somewhat strange. First of all, it lists a bunch of nice things that God did for us. And what's the word we would use in Hebrew for nice things that God does for us? What word would you use?
Chasadim.
What? Chasadim, right. I would expect kama chasadim tovim. That's first of all. Malot is a weird word. The second thing is, makom is not the usual name we use for Hashem, even at the Seder. What's the name we use for Hashem throughout the Seder when we're not making a bracha or quoting a pasuk?
Kodesh Baruch Hu.
Right. HaKodesh Baruch Hu matzilenu mi'adam. Kodesh Baruch Hu mechashev et haketz. Makom is used in a couple places. What?
Yeah, Baruch HaMakom.
Right. So Baruch HaMakom, which is in place of a bracha, meaning instead of Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, so HaMakom sort of takes its place. Understood. But here it's a little bit strange. You would say, Kama Ma'alot Tovot, or Kama Chasadim Tovim, LaHashem Aleinu, LaElokeinu Aleinu, or LaElokeinu. And the makom is a little bit strange also. Notice that the makom is repeated in the introduction to the second half. And you would say, again, it should be Lakadosh Baruch Hu Aleinu, Lelokeinu Aleinu, or something of that sort. So makom seems to be playing a role here also. There's yet another problem here, which is the tone of the evening. So let's roll back to the Arba Kosot, which I believe we talked about last year. Why do we have Arba Kosot at the Seder? So we've talked about it. There's Arba Kosot because there's four different components to the meal, each of which requires a kos. That's understood. But what's the most popular explanation to the Arba Kosot? The one that Rashbam and Rashi quotes in the beginning of Arba Pesachim and the Midrash comments on in Parshat Va'era. What's the famous explanation?
Arba Lashonot Tegula.
Right. Otsetiv, Otsiv, Itzaltiv, Galtiv, Lagachti. To which, of course, one could raise the objection that there should not be four, but there should be five cups. Because after Hashem promises he's going to do all those things, what's the next thing he promises? Right? Which is why I've seen some people who, since 1940, there's a move to do this in 48, and there's been more recently another move to do this, to add a fifth cup, because Ve'veti has been realized. All right, I'm not going to get into that, and I don't think it's appropriate, but I'm not going to get into why. But you notice that that's not standardized. Why is it not standardized? And nobody even challenges and says, based on that explanation, there should be five cups. Because Ve'viti is not part of the evening. Ve'viti belongs to Sukkot, maybe to Shavuot, maybe to every day of the year, maybe the rest of Pesach. But Seder night is about Yitziat Mitzrayim, which makes this list also strange, because if you were to put parameters around the experience of Yitziat Mitzrayim and say, how early in history would you date the beginning of the process called Yitziat Mitzrayim? What's the first thing you would point to and say, oh, Yitziat Mitzrayim has begun? What would you think?
Either when Moshe arrives or the first Makkah, maybe?
Right, when Moshe arrived, the first Makkah. I would have said at the Sneh, maybe, when Hashem inaugurates Moshe and charges him with the mission. All right, good, okay. Where would you put the other side? Where would you put the end of Yitziat Mitzrayim? What point would you say that's Yitziat Mitzrayim, afterwards or something else?
Coming to Eretz Yisrael.
Meaning coming to Eretz Yisrael is part of Yitziat Mitzrayim, or is it the next
thing? That's the end of Yitziat Mitzrayim.
That's the end. So the end of Yitziat Mitzrayim is when they cross the Jordan. Right. And that's, of course, beautiful bookends. They left by crossing a sea. They come by crossing water. That's both in Nisan. That's on the 10th of Nisan. Then they cross the Ardain. Very nice. Okay. I'm willing to go. I'd go a little bit earlier than that. But fine. We'll for argument's sake, we'll accept that. And notice that in the evening, for the most part, all the things we talk about really are about the actual Exodus. Now, in the Haggadah math, we get into Kriyat Yamsuf. By the way, that's about it. Right? The hand, the finger. Right, but take a look at this list. How far do we go on this list? This list does not end with Yitzhak Mitzrayim. It ends with
the Beit HaMikdash.
Well, that's kind of strange. What does that have to do with anything? And of course, the real doozy of a question in this whole thing is Dayenu. I get real. Dayenu is not accurate to say about any of these things. If Hashem would take us out of Mitzrayim but not done the Makot, okay, I get Dayenu. But if he had taken us out but not split the sea, then it would have really been Dayenu. We would have died. Or if he had taken us on the Midbar and not fed us, it would have been Dayenu. Yeah, we would have died. And didn't give us the Torah? Come on. So how do we explain Dayenu? It's a very strange thing. So we have a few questions to deal with there. So I'd like to suggest that our author, whoever the author is, the anonymous author of Dayenu, from whenever, somewhere in the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, whenever it is, was trying to craft a hymn that would really reflect the position we're supposed to be at in the climax of the experience of the evening. I'll explain. Even though the tale we're telling is a tale of Yetziat Mitzrayim, the event that we're celebrating is Yetziat Mitzrayim. The experience we're supposed to be having is much broader than that. Not only deeper than that, but broader than that. And it really stretches over all of Jewish history. Remember, we don't start our evening with Moshe. We don't even start our meeting with our evening with Mechirat Yosef. We start our evening with Terach. We go all the way back to the earliest points of what you might call Jewish history and start there. How far ahead do we go in the evening? Not in telling the story, but in the experience? I submit to you that during the evening, at a particular point, and for everybody it's a different point, but the goal is to reach a point where we have reached Yimot HaMashiach, where we are there. Perhaps it's during Hallel, the Hallel after the meal, and we're sitting there, Odcha Hashem, Odcha Ki Ani Tanim Tili Shua, perhaps at that moment, whatever it is, we are in Yerushalayim. We're eating Korban Pesach. We are sovereign and secure in our land. The world has come to its realization. History has been realized. It's all great. That, of course, is, in the meantime, still an illusion, which is shattered when, at the end, we sing the celebratory words, but they're really kind of mournful words, which is L'shana Abab Yerushalayim Abnia. That this image will be real next year. Right now, it's just an image. Right now, it's just something for us to picture and to give us what to work for. Okay. So I believe that the author is trying to take us to that place. And that may be why this was originally a song sung after the meal and not as part of the Haggadah. He's trying to take us to that place. So the first thing he does is he goes all the way to the Beit HaMikdash in his description. The second thing is that he builds in, and Jason already jumped to this, he builds in 15 items, and he calls them ma'alot, which takes us to the famous Mishnah in Sukkah that describes the Simchat Beit HaShoeva and describes the Levim singing on the 15 steps that Herod had put into the newly built Mikdash, that went from Ezrat Nashim up to the Ezrat Yisrael, and the Levim stood on those steps, they're wide steps, stood on those and sang, and he constructed it to correspond to the 15 Shir HaMa'alot in Tehillim. And some people mistakenly think the 15 Shir HaMa'alot were written to correspond to the 15 steps. The steps came later. And Shir HaMa'alot, so good, he calls them Ma'alot. So now we have these 15 Ma'alot, and now by having this falsely, sort of arbitrarily extended list of items to get us to 15, and calling them ma'alot, and referring to hamakom, There's all these subtle hints to take us to the Beit HaMikdash. In other words, not in your face, but just an illusion, kind of a feeling. We're in the Beit HaMikdash. 15, Makom, Ma'alot, Yafet. And we go all the way to the Beit HaMikdash. It's very nice. But there's something more going on here. That way also explains why he stretches out the list. But you think about the items here, there's something else going on. The key line in the Mishnah that impacts on Haggadah is source 6 here, which is Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer, Kol Shel Amar Shlosha Dvarim Elu BaPesach, Lo Yatzai Yedei Chovato. We're all familiar with this. Eilim Pesach, Matzah, Maror, or Pesach, Mirorim, and Matzah, different nuschot, right? And explain what they are. Now notice Rabban Gamliel, in finding the obligation to explain these items, perhaps is continuing a family tradition that goes back several generations in his family, son after father, to Hillel. Hillel, after all, was his great-great-great-grandfather, I think. And Hillel's halachic position about the Korban Pesach was distinct from that of his colleagues. His colleagues felt that the pasuk that says, Al matzot marim yochlu, that the word al means with. Like Alav Matei Menashet. And therefore, you'd have some Pesach, you have some Matzah, you have some Moro. Hillel held that Al meant on top of. And it's a sugi of mitzvot mitzvot lo zuadzu. And he said, therefore, you have to eat the Matzah and the Moro and the Pesach all at one bite, ki'ilu, meaning as one food. And that's what we do, Zechel Mikdash Kehillel. What's that all about? So I submit that the evening, as I said, is an evening in which we're experiencing all of Jewish history. We're experiencing Yetziat Mitzrayim. We're also experiencing Lavan. We're also experiencing Terach and Brit Ben Abatarim and all sorts of other events, including an as yet unrealized history of the world coming to its completion, to history coming to its completion. And I believe that you can make the argument that in our history, every major moment could be classified as a Moror moment, a Matzah moment, or a Pesach moment. What do I mean? So Moror moment is very easy to identify. I mean, I ask this in class, and immediately the students say October 7th. And I think that's accurate. October 7th was a Moror moment, a moment of great bitterness. Pesach is also easier, not as easy as Maror. But think about what Korban Pesach was. Korban Pesach was a Korban we're eating in our homes, safe and secure, while Hashem is protecting our houses, while next door people are screaming and crying because their sons just died. And it carries the implication of an intimate and exclusive relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is protecting us, while others are not so protected. So that closeness and the exclusivity of it. And you think about it, there are moments in history, unfortunately, they are harder to think of, especially this year, but there are moments in history that you could easily call Pesach moments. To my mind, Entebbe is a good example. July 4th, 1976 is a great example of a Pesach moment. When the rest of the world turns around and says, Mikam Chai Yisrael. They recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand, and they recognize our special relationship, etc. 1967, very easily, by the time the dust settles on June 11th, Mikam Chai Yisrael, Mikam Yisrael, Asher Hashem Karov Eleim, etc. It's a realization among people who have their eyes open that we've got a special relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's an exclusive one. Call those Pesach moments. I'd call 48 a Pesach moment, maybe November 29th, 1947, a Pesach moment. Matzah is a little harder. Matzah is the food of refugees. It's not the food, it's also the food of slaves, but we think of it as the food of refugees. Even though it's also the food of nobility, because it's eaten with the Pesach, chiefly the focus in the Torah on matzah is something that you bake quickly and take with you on the run. It's good road food. It doesn't go bad because it's never very good. And it's easy to make quickly. Matzah. So refugees, you think about it, are people who are between Maror and Pesach. They're trying to climb out of Maror and get to Pesach. The Simon Wiesenthal Center has won over the years two Academy Awards. The second one, was after I was already working at the center, so I was part of the celebration there, and I had nothing, no credit whatsoever for this film, was for a documentary called The Long Way Home. And The Long Way Home was done in like 1998 or 99, and it was a documentary about the years 45 through 48, between Shoah and Medina, everything that happened in from all sorts of perspectives. It's really a marvelous film. And Matzah is The Long Way Home. Matzah is not Auschwitz, but Matzah is also not 1948. It's getting there, doing the work to get there. And my Rebbe, Amital Zatzal, used to refer to our generation as a generation of Achshavistim. Everybody wants everything now. Shalom Achshav, Mashiach Achshav. But that's not how it works. It works as you roll up your sleeves and you do the hard work and you get one step closer. And that's our job. That's Matzah. So I'd like to suggest that what Hillel was saying is that you really need to, at this evening, part of what this event's about is to internalizing and ingesting all three identifiers with all of Jewish history. I identify with Jewish celebration. I identify with Jewish suffering. And I identify with Jewish hard work, with draining swamps. I identify with all that, and I internalize it. And years later, a Mangamuel comes along and says, you also have to explain it. You have to explain what these three things are. Now, if you look at it, you realize that where Dayenu ended up getting placed in our Haggadah is right before Rabbi Gamliel's declaration. Right? By the way, there's a minig that some have, the Gaon's opposed to this, minig that some have to read Haggadah from Avadim Hayinu, all the Otel L'chaper Kol Avonoteinu, but not Rabbi Gamliel. That's the next line, because that can only be said at the Seder. The Gaon was opposed to the whole piece, but the whole minhag. But Gamliel's next. So if you look at it, you realize that if you look at these items, you'll see that they are actually grouped into not only 15, but three groups of five. The first five items you can see here all took place in Egypt. The next five items all took place on the road. They're part of travel. And the next five items are all about closeness, intimacy, and exclusive relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Take a look at this chart down here and you'll see it. And it's as if we're saying Maror, Matzah, Pesach, five of each, symmetrical, getting us to 15, the Beit HaMikdash, Ma'alot, all of this brilliantly put together in this hymn. And so we can understand something of the structure and the necessity of adding components to it in order to get us to this sense of a culmination of all of Jewish history, culminating in the Beit HaMikdash, and all the steps being taken, and all of the steps being alighted upon. That still leaves us with our first question and our last question. First question is, why are the two paragraphs? And the last question is, Dayenu? So I can explain it, but I have a story which explains it better. I think Jason may remember this story. In any case, I'll tell
you. Before you do that, can you go back to that chart that had the three columns?
Sure. You can download. I mean, I sent it out.
I know it's on your sheet. So your notion is that the first three are inside Mitzrayim. That's the
first five.
I mean, right?
And yeah, they're all in Mitzrayim. Look at them; they are.
I'm sorry. Right, but that's how you're grouping them. Is the
right? The first five are in Mitzrayim. The next five are on the road. That's Matzah, and the next five are about the intimate, exclusive relationship we have with Hashem: Shabbat, Har Sinai, Torah, Eretz Yisrael, Beit HaBichira.
And how does that track to Pesach Matzah Maror?
That's exactly what Pesach Matzah Maror is. Maror is suffering.
Right.
Matzah is doing the work to get from suffering to nobility. And Pesach is nobility. Pesach is that special relationship with Hashem. Correct.
Got it.
Okay, good. Okay, so we still have the first and last question. So I'm going to tell a story. And it's a story that happened in L.A. when I was a kid. I was not part of it. I can't attest to this story. I got it all secondhand. But nonetheless, so as you probably know, Jews first got to California in 1848 or 49. They came to San Francisco, not to L.A., and they came there ahead of the gold rush, as they did with any movement westward. There were Jews there to open up the stores, with the dry goods, et cetera, to service the pioneers, as it were.
Jews, the Frisco kid.
Well, Frisco kid, exactly. It's actually very accurate, except I mean, not, but it's it is, and sadly also an accurate picture. San Francisco has been forever an almost impossible town for Orthodoxy to make headway in because it has these very strong Reform roots. They're very hard to deal with. In any case, but Jews got to L.A. and there was a smattering of Jews here in the late 1800s, but for the most part, it happened between the world wars is the beginning of people coming here. And there was a very small community near downtown L.A. It wasn't even Boyle Heights, before Boyle Heights. And there was a, people are not aware of this, but there was a nascent tshuva movement among young German Jews in the 1920s. Famously, Ludwig Strauss was actually part of that. But it wasn't big, but it was a movement. And there was a young couple that ended up coming to L.A. I don't know why they got here. And they were from newlyweds. They were from. They didn't know all that much, but they were from. But they knew some basics. And they were newlyweds, and they arrived in L.A. And the fellow had the last name of Hotzenplotz. So the Hotzenplotz, Mr. and Mrs. Hotzenplotz. I don't even know their first names. So Mrs. Hotzenplotz turns around and says to her husband, I can't live here. Because we're married and I have no mikvah. And she knew enough to know that she couldn't be with her husband without a mikvah. And so for a little while, they went to the Pacific Ocean and they did this. And then they did what they could. But it wasn't a solution. So she started going around. And most of the Jews who were living here, the people who founded Union Bank in L.A., most of the Jews who were living here at the time were German Reform Jews. So she went around to them, and they were already, she was German also, but had no interest in somebody who was observant. And she was lobbying them to build a mikveh, but she was such a pest that after a while, they finally broke down, and they ended up buying a house, small house. And the back half of the house, they had carved out and built into a nice bath, nice for those days. Being L.A., it took a while before they collected enough water for a mikveh, and then a mikveh. And that was the first mikveh in L.A., and all the mikvot in L.A. that we're familiar with are all started with that. All right. She and her husband were blessed with a daughter and a year later a son. And this is now, by the way, the end of the 20s. So the Depression hit. By the way, very soon, not a lot of people know this, very soon, L.A. became flooded with people coming from the Dust Bowl. They're called Okies. And so there was a lot of people and not a lot of work. So everybody's scrambling to try to make a living. And she was now raising a two-year-old and a two-year-old. And she had to go to work. And in those days, there was a new business that opened up that has been going ever since. It started because of the Depression. It was called daycare centers. And the idea was that a woman would open up her house and take a few dollars from 10 different women and take their kids in and watch their kids and give them some snack and sing songs to them and make sure they didn't get hurt. And that was the day, and then those women could go to work. But unfortunately, and this is the reality throughout the country at the time, nearly all of the daycare centers were run by very frumme Christian women. You walked in the house, you saw a yoizel on the wall, and they said and sang little songs about Jesus, and they said little prayers every day, and obviously the food was not anything you could eat. And so Hotzenplotz said, I'm not going to have my daughter and son go to this. So she goes around to the same people now 2 years later and starts pestering them and gets them to agree to hire somebody. And the front half of the house where the mikveh is becomes the first Jewish daycare center in L.A. All right, very nice. And a few women bring their kids. This gets crazy because when her daughter becomes five and it's time for her to go to public school, I don't know if you guys remember, but public school back in the day was very different than it is today. It was really a very Christian environment. I mean, look, I went to public school as a kid, and this is after Sullivan, and they were still having Christmas pageants, and I learned all the songs, and very nice. But before that, there used to be prayer in schools. And she doesn't want that for her kids. So she goes around, and again, pestering the same people that she bothered 5 years or 3 years earlier, and they end up renting a building down the block, and they hire somebody, and they have a one-room schoolhouse for a few kids and attracts a few more kids, and that's the first Jewish day school on the West Coast, right there. I don't even know what it's called. Her daughter finally graduates sixth grade. That's as far as they can go. They can't sponsor anything more. So she goes to the local high school, actually junior high school, they used to call it, junior high and then high school. And Mahatzaplatz is concerned about her education and about meeting Jewish kids. So she starts a program that she calls Jewish High School. Later it gets changed to Hebrew High School. And after World War II, it gets renamed Los Angeles Hebrew High School, where I went as a kid. We used to have 650 kids there every Sunday. And I came back years later and I worked there. I was a teacher and I was associate principal of the school for 4 years. Great school. And unfortunately, closed only a couple of years ago. And the idea was, in those days, the kids would come on Sunday and 4 afternoons a week, what we call cheder, Talmud Torah, and they would learn. Anyways, her kids graduated high school, her daughter, and then 2 years later, her son graduated from high school and graduated from Hebrew High, where they called it Hebrew High, and went to where everybody in those days went, which was a college that we call JUCLA. That's what we used to refer to it as. All right, all Jewish kids went to UCLA. They didn't go out of town. Israel wasn't even something to think about. They didn't go back east. And they, by the way, didn't go to USC either. They all went to UCLA. And she visited them on the campus. So there was nothing there. There's no kosher food. There was no Jewish activities. And there were a lot of other activities. This is after the Second World War. The beginning of activities on campus and things like that. Nothing for them, no Jewish fraternities. So she set up a little program for them. Again, raised money, pestered the heck out of people, and raised money and started a little program, which eventually became program that you all know as Hillel. The Hillel on campus. It got swallowed up into the national program. But she's the one who started it. All right.
Hillel began in L.A.
That part of it, yeah. It actually began elsewhere, but that was actually began in Champaign-Urbana. But that part got brought in. So she started locally. So her kids, because they're observant, grew up, moved away, met people back east. I think they both lived in New York. I don't think either of them are alive anymore. And she and her husband passed away. And she was living in L.A. Her husband had left, you know, first, so she was able to live on her own. But she wasn't really affiliated with any organization because she'd done so much for the whole community. And the community wasn't all that well organized. And in 1970, some people in the community decided, you know, we don't know how long she's going to be here. She's getting close to 70, which in those days was end of lifetime. And she and they wanted to honor her. And there had been a brand new hotel built in L.A. that was the glamour spot of L.A., which was known as the Century Plaza Hotel. It's still around, but in those days, it was the newest thing. It was very exciting. So they rented out a small banquet hall that seated about 400 people in the Century Plaza Hotel. And they scheduled for May 1970 at some point a dinner to honor her. And they put out a notice in the local Jewish paper, a couple of papers, the Heritage, the Neighborhood Messenger. They put in a little notice saying, we're having this dinner to honor her. And they told all her friends, make sure she doesn't see the paper on that day. And said, auditions for the dinner will be at the Century Plaza Hotel this coming Friday. Anybody interested in emceeing the program, come. So three men showed up to emcee the program. The first one of them, and they said to the committee said to them, whichever one of you proposes the program that we adopt will be the MC. Very good. So the first guy says, look, nobody likes speeches. They're coming to a dinner, very nice. I think what we should have is a life-size, like, structure of a picture of the mikveh, the original building of the mikveh, and on the other side of it, today's new mikveh that we just built in Pico. And we should have a picture of the daycare and then the new West Side JCC daycare. All five things, right? People come in, they'll see it, sit down, they'll call her out, they'll give her a plaque. Shkoyach, everybody go home. The second guy said, I think that's short selling her. She's done a lot. I think that we should have people stand up and recognize each one of her achievements. They have the five pillars that you mentioned. And people should stand up and thank her for the mikveh and thank her for this, right? Thank for all the things that she's done. Because every mikveh in LA started with hers and every Jewish day school, etc. So they said, okay, that's a good idea. You got the job. The third guy says, what about me? So I won't tell you what the third guy said because that's what happened. So I'll describe what happened. In the end, they couldn't use the room because they needed the big banquet hall that seats 2,000. And they filled it. There was not one empty seat. 2,000 people came to honor Mrs. Hatzafatz. The word spread like wildfire, and everybody came to honor her. It was beautiful. Everybody walks in and sees these five big pillars. You look at it and you see an old decrepit building, and underneath it says first mikveh in LA. You go around, you see a beautiful mikveh that's just been built on the other side. daycare center, new daycare center, all five things. Beautiful. People come sit in the table, to the table, have their dinner. On the table, there are information sheets with her little biography, where she was born and her husband and her kids, etc., and all the things she's done. And then the MC gets up and says the following. If Mrs. Hudson Flats had only built the first mikveh in L.A., we would have a dinner to honor her. Everybody in the room who has benefited in any way from any mikveh in L.A., please get up and start clapping. So, of course, it's really embarrassing. So, like, 10 old ladies stand up and start clapping. All right. And then he says, if she had only built the first mikveh, but not the first Jewish daycare center in L.A., we would have a dinner to thank her. Anybody who has benefited from any Jewish daycare center in L.A., stand up and start clapping. If you're already standing, stand on a chair. So the waiters help these 10 old ladies onto the chairs, and they're clapping, and about 100 people stand up and start clapping in their place. And then he says, if she had only built the first Jewish daycare center, but not the first Jewish day school, we would have a dinner to thank her. Anybody who's benefited in any way from a Jewish day school, stand up and start clapping. If you're already standing, stand on a chair. Standing on a chair, get on a table. So the 10 old ladies are now on a table, and helped up by the waiters. 100 people are standing on chairs clapping. The place is starting to go crazy. And 1,000 people are standing up clapping. Because every one of them has either gone to day school, sent a kid to day school, and they realize they're also the product of a successful mikveh. And they sent their kids to daycare, or they went to daycare. So suddenly 1,000 people are clapping. The place is starting to go crazy. Then he says, if she'd only built the first Jewish day school, we'd have a dinner to honor her. If she'd only built the first Jewish day school, but not built the first Hebrew High program, we'd have a dinner to honor her. The same thing happens. And now 1,500 people are standing. You're in the minority if you're sitting. They're standing clapping. 1,000 people are standing on chairs clapping. 100 people are standing on tables clapping. And 10 old ladies are swinging from chandeliers. And they're starting to scream, Hots and Flats, Hots and Flats, Hots and Flats. And the waiters think that the Jews are nuts. And then he says, and if she had only built the first Hebrew High program, but not the Hillel program on campus, we'd have a dinner to thank her. And by this time, everybody's standing, they're screaming, they're yelling, they're jumping up and down, they're screaming, swinging from chandeliers, bouncing off the walls, screaming, Hots and Flats, Hots and Flats. And then he finally gets them a little quiet and he yells, but she did build the first mikveh. And they'll go, yay! And she did build the first Jewish daycare center. Yay! And she built the first Jewish day school. Hooray! And she built the first Hebrew High program. Yay! And she built the first campus program for Jewish kids. Yay! And the place is screaming, Hots and Flats, and the walls are starting to cave down, and paint is peeling from the walls. And finally, they walk this old lady out, and the place goes berserk. That's Dayenu.